the point was that if we really want to stay relevant and we really need to think about the sort of the next 5 years and the future of media and all that good stuff, we had to have tools to enable us to see, that we had to have the visibility.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this, the first Media Voices episode of the new decade. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Peter Houston.
And I'm Esther Thorpe. Now, that quote you just heard is from Elizabeth Branson-Bordreau, who is the CEO and publisher at the MIT Technology Review. In the interview this week, we talk about some of the work she's done to transform the business and bring it to new audiences, how they strike the balance between writing content that appeals to experts but is also understandable by the rest of us, and what they've got planned for the future, including podcast plans.
Boom!
Speaking of boom, the shortlist has been released for the Publisher Podcast Awards.
Woo!
Yeah. That's been a hell of a lot of work, but it's been amazing to see the quality of entries.
We've been talking about like the standard of entries for months now, so it is great that we've finally been able to actually put that out there.
Yeah, exactly, because everyone was always going to say that. And
if
I felt
people
like
wanted to see the shortlist, where would they go?
The shortlist and tickets are all available at publisherpodcastawards.com, or we're on Twitter at pubpodawards. So before the interview, we're going to do our first news roundup of the new decade. And the big news this week is that News UK has won, effectively, a battle on UK VAT. So, Peter, why don't you take us through kind of the technicalities of this, and then we'll go into why it matters.
Well, first off, I have to say it's a bit weird to be celebrating a victory by News UK.
You know, I was thinking this, because it's not the first one. Do you remember they were kind of instrumental in getting First Click eliminated as well, on behalf of publishers?
They're not always progressive on that stuff. But this has been coming for a very long time, or we've been waiting a very long time for this.
For our non-UK audiences, can you explain the VAT thing?
Yeah,
for the UK listeners as well, like myself, can you explain VAT?
So the basic idea is that in the UK, there is value-added tax, VAT, charged on goods and services. That's a add-on of about 20%. It goes straight to the government. And it had been charged on digital subscriptions, but not print subscriptions.
Why the distinction? What's the...
Well, actually, it's not just print subscriptions. It's just print sales. Well, the real reason is because the law that defined VAT on newspapers and stuff was formed in, or was made in 1972. Long before anyone thought there was ever going to be a digital newspaper. What that basically means is that ever since we've had digital editions, online websites, whatever it is, they've been charged at 20%. So for someone like The Times and Sunday Times, with 300,000 digital subscribers across the board, if they were all paying £26 a month, they probably don't. But if you take that as a baseline, their tax savings could be worth like £15 million a year for News UK.
That's not chicken feed.
Oops.
Because presumably, News UK would only be getting about £21-22 of that 26.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point. They can either cut the subscriptions to make it cheaper for people to subscribe, or they can pocket the difference.
Well, let's be honest, it's not going to be the first one.
Okay, so why have News UK specifically won this? Because the PPA has been campaigning for this for a while. This is where my head melts.
This is where we totally geek out on
it. It's like the ultimate loophole.
So News UK successfully argued that the Times digital edition, and digital edition on tablets and phones, but also on the website, is effectively a print newspaper.
because
it's updated infrequently. It's only updated, I think since 2016, the Times has only been updated four times a day. Yeah?
Yeah.
They made that switch in like March 2016. So what they're arguing is that because it's updated infrequently, it's a print edition or the equivalent of a print edition, so they shouldn't be paying VAT on it. And this tribunal's gone, oh, yeah.
Cool. Does this then open the door to other edition-based apps?
Yeah, and also books. Because there's the same thing applies to books, isn't it?
That's quite interesting because, what was it, between September and December, there were like 6 or 7 apps that launched that were specifically around editions. I wonder if they saw this coming. They can now backclaim, can't they? That's like...
No. See, that's box. I reckon that's box. So The Guardian raised the prospect in their coverage of this that News UK could claim back tens of millions of pounds in wrongly paid VAT and subscriptions dating back to September 2010 when the Times first put up the paywall. They weren't additions. There was a it's like any other, like the Guardian's website or the BBC website is constantly updated at that point. It was only in 2016 that they went to this addition. So if the ruling's based on the addition side of things,
they could still claim back a substantial amount of money from 2016. Though I'm not saying they could go all the way back to 2010.
3 years, but not a decade. Yeah,
no, it's still going to total a couple of million, surely.
Yeah, it's not chicken feed. I love this stuff. It's just so geeky. It's like. This is the kind of thing that just makes you go, wow.
We've asked the question in the news roundup, is this another nail in Prince's coffin?
Absolutely. Is it? And you know, is this going to be people saying, do you know what?
Yeah, finally.
If we can save this money in subscriptions. We're not getting involved in that. Can we just say, let's just focus completely on digital? I don't think so. I mean, I think it's an interesting question, but I don't think it will actually have that much bearing.
No, it might be, you know, if you imagine this kind of seesaw and then this is just kind of another feather placed on the Prince's dead end.
Oh, nice image.
Thanks.
I also think there's an interesting confluence, if that's a good word.
It is.
Where you've got data, you've got audience data showing that people actually prefer limited content updates. Mm-hmm. You know, the less is more thing that we've been seeing and we've talked about from a bunch of people. Esther's talking about the apps that have come out. There's websites that have been putting out less content. Tortoise, the whole thing is based on less content. The Correspondent. So there's a trend in the market for less content less often. And if that comes together with this new tax ruling, then there's a definite kind of momentum for this to become a thing.
But I can remember asking Sam Baker about this. Again, RI people. And she was saying that when they were doing the research for this, there was just such a clear trend that when they asked people when they looked at stuff, it was always breakfast, lunch, after work, and then maybe before they went to bed. They're like, it's just those four clear spike points. Huh. And that people just feel really overwhelmed if stuff is still coming out the rest of the day. They just want four clear points that they can, you know, check in. And I did the same thing with my news apps. You know, it tends to be on the way to work and on the way back from work. And that's my 2 points.
I think that what this might accelerate is this bifurcation of the news model, where we do have these kind of subscription-based, edition-based.
Did we just use confluence and bifurcation in the same episode?
Yeah.
It's 9 a.m., guys. Come on. I think if our listeners are geeking out on this just as much as Peter is, you should check back in a few weeks for our next Conversations episode.
Oh, yeah?
Where we'll be talking about this.
Next up on the docket, Twitter is offering tweeters the options to limit replies. But will it make a difference, and is it a good idea? So after all the furore of the past couple of years about abuse on Twitter and that Twitter was effectively washing its hands and not doing enough to counter that, it's finally introducing 4 options for when you tweet. So if you tag your tweet as being global, that will let anybody reply. Group is for people who you follow and mention. Panel is for the people who you specifically mention in the tweet. And statement effectively just allows you to broadcast a tweet and receive no replies. So in theory, at least, it's potentially a good way to avoid the dog piles that tend to pop up when somebody prominent makes any sort of statement on Twitter.
I saw this and my first thought was Trump is going to love that statement option. Yeah, and anything I think Trump would like, I don't think is a good thing.
No.
Is it just about replies or is it about shares?
So at the moment, it's just about replies.
But then can you quote tweet? Because that's where a lot of the crap comes in. You quote tweet and somebody else is like, no, quote tweet this, quote tweet this.
I don't know about the quote tweet side of it. I think it's just, obviously they have the data. I think that they see where a lot of the abuse is coming from. And maybe it's just because we are kind of in this journalistic bubble. We see people doing that kind of stuff, you know, quote tweeting when they disagree. I think that your average Twitter user potentially does just reply and call somebody a dick. Rather than, you know, taking the time to quote tweet it.
I think you've got to separate two things. One is the broadcast aspect to this, like Trump, who's just, whatever happens, Trump's going to broadcast his shite. Where I think this could be really useful is where, like, a normal human being, particularly a woman, makes a statement that just gets all this crap piling up in the replies afterwards. You know, that kind of rampant bullshit misogyny that you see on Twitter.
Yeah.
It's not just women, but you know what I mean.
It drives people off Twitter.
So that's the thing, but it's one of those things where I feel like that's a really good use case for it. You know, I can see, especially like female politicians in this country, with the amount of stuff they get, to actually be able to limit that a little bit. is good for everybody. But there's so much as well I see on Twitter where people have tweeted like a false story or something's not quite right. And it's the replies that like actually, and often quite politely, that are like, you know, actually, you know, they post like a Snopes link or something and say, yeah, what you posted is actually not quite accurate. At which point the person does then engage with it. And if you switch that off and you post something fake, it just gives you this platform to post it without anybody being like, yeah, that actually that's not right.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I can see the. Do you know what I think is interesting in this? That whether this is right or wrong or what, I think it's interesting that Twitter is actually trying to make an effort to fix some of this.
Now, to give them their due, they have been trialing things over the last couple of years. It's just that none of them have been as wide-ranging and as immediately impactful as this one.
I guess that's my point.
But then there's a bigger thing to this that perhaps... See, I thought that they were just going to try and get better at kicking people who were abusive off the platform. You know, you're abusive, one strike out.
But I struggle with that, though. How does that work? Because everyone, you know, one man's abuse is another man's sensible comment.
Yeah.
I also think, you know, because inevitably they're going to automate this. And it's just going to get weird.
Yeah, so because when I first read this, I thought, oh, it's a bit like Facebook. You know, you've got your friends, you've got your friends of friends in your public options. But actually, the thing is, you will still see tweets from people that have got these options on. It's not like a privacy setting. But I don't know if maybe it would have been better as a more privacy star setting. So a bit like you can lock your account, if they just had some more options around who can see your tweets rather than who can reply.
I guess their whole thing is they want a public conversation.
But the public aren't capable of having a civilized conversation.
Oh, here we go. It's like S is one step away from a eugenics argument.
Oh, my God.
No, with any platform that is open to everybody in the world, it's going to be open to abuse.
What are you trying to say, Esther, that people are stupid?
People are inherently bad.
You're trying to do a Boris Johnson here. Actually, it's Boris Johnson's dad, wasn't it?
Yeah. I don't think they even know how to spell Pinocchio.
No, just wherever you go, there are pockets of people who will take every opportunity to do this. Not everybody, but there are pockets of people.
Nice, you wrote that back beautifully.
Maybe I should be a politician.
But I think this is right.
Sorry.
I mean, we're all right at this point. It's like you want to have that open conversation. You don't want to let people who just broadcast misinformation get away with it without countering it. I do just wonder how many people actually look at a tweet, go into the replies and go, oh, actually, there is counter evidence. I feel like it's a limited use case, you know?
I feel like I do that quite... If I see something that is not quite believable, I'll always check the comments.
Yeah, but we are not normal.
Thanks.
Now for the news in brief. So we spoke about this actually a couple of months ago when it was first mooted, but The Sun has sort of quietly launched its, quote, distinct brand of tabloid journalism, thanks to The Drum for that tactful warning, in the US this week. It's an interesting one. All the coverage has basically said they want to replicate their UK success over in the US. When we spoke about it, we said the US is awash with this kind of journalism already. What will it take for The Sun US to stand out from the crowd?
Okay, so this is quite interesting. I feel like the US is more polarised than the UK.
Oh, it's, no, yeah. Well,
not the press, no.
Do you not think?
No, the US press is way... I think you're thinking broadcast.
Possibly.
Yeah.
If you think of the press is in terms of the newspapers are largely regarded, I think, as liberal.
Oh, poor people in the US. They've got to deal with Trump and now they've got to deal with The Sun coming in as well.
So Teen Vogue, which we all loved, right?
Yeah.
Or love, has got into hot water earlier this week when it posted, then removed, well, actually posted, then updated, then removed, a glowing story about Facebook doing some stuff to protect the integrity of the 2020 American elections.
Yeah.
Basically, this is sponsored content, but they didn't label it properly. The editorial team didn't know anything about it.
This became like a mystery that the world was trying to solve in real time because the person who was attributed as author originally then denied that they'd written it.
Oh, that's nuts. But also the timing of it's come out as weird because it was published at exactly the same time as a New York Times report that leaked internal correspondence from Facebook execs admitting that Facebook should probably be blamed for Donald Trump's election, if that's the right terminology, or congratulated, depending on depending on what colour of baseball hat you wear. It's just weird.
Wow. Yeah, there seemed to be a fundamental disconnect between what Facebook thought they were paying for on Teen Vogue and what Teen Vogue thought that they were doing.
Yeah. Some good print news. Outside Magazine has seen a 41% bump in print readership in 2019 after recognising and committing to serve audience segments that have been traditionally underserved by the outdoor magazine market.
Whoa. Like,
what does that mean?
If you want a translation for that, that basically means that they started targeting women. Apparently.
Like someone sat going, oh, I know, there's like 50% of the population maybe we could try and talk to.
Moving on, major flaws have been found in TikTok, which would have allowed hackers to manipulate and reveal personal data. TikTok claims the vulnerabilities have been fixed. This is a hell of a ball drop considering all the focus that's been put on data breaches over the last couple of months.
But it wasn't actually manipulated. It was just a big hole that could have been manipulated. So
yeah.
They say they fixed it. All good.
So Italian Vogue isn't publishing photos this month in an aim to make a statement about sustainability. In a post, it highlighted the environmental impact of filling a magazine with photographs each month. This is a story. That makes no sense to me. From the flights required to light photo shoots to catering to garment packing and all this other stuff. Yeah, I get it, but isn't there a bunch of other stuff that you could do to highlight sustainability? Like, I don't know, use potato starch bags or whatever.
Well, yeah, print on sort of non-laminated paper, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but that's long-term like stuff. This is a stunt. It is. It's a stunt, but it's highlighting it.
It's great for illustrators. Anyway, Tumblr, although I thought that they were no longer a thing since banning
porn. No, they're less of a thing because there's no porn on there.
Okay. So they've launched an internet literacy campaign to help young users spot suspicious activity.
So Facebook is now going to start banning manipulated videos that it considers to be deep fakes, but shallow fakes and otherwise manipulated video are still allowed. I don't know if you saw a couple of social apps this week basically launched deep fake type tech of their own to let you dance in the place of a celebrity and all that kind of stuff. So there's a very fine line here.
Pre-tax losses at Vice UK have grown by 75% in 2018. According to the company's latest financial figures, they're blaming Brexit. Oh, God, man, we got to almost the end of an episode without mentioning Brexit.
And finally, news website rating tool NewsGuard, which is the one that hilariously gave Mail Online a red rating a few months back, is adopting a subscription model with membership costing $1.95 a month. It is planning a range of new features as part of this, including warnings about hoax healthcare info and conspiracy theories. I cannot see anybody who needs to pay for this actually paying for this.
It would be like trying to sell people who believe in horoscopes warnings about the fact that horoscopes are bullshit.
You're on fire this morning.
I don't think that's controversial, is it?
No, it's good. It's just a really good analogy. That's two you've had.
So this week I spoke to Elizabeth Bramson-Bordreau, who is the CEO and publisher at MIT Technology Review. She joined the publication back in 2015 when it still had a reputation as a legacy brand. So I started by asking her what changes she's made during that time to evolve its offering and bring it to new audiences.
So I joined in 2015. I had been at The Economist in the UK, actually, before that, and had moved back to the US for family reasons. And it was a legacy publication. And when the opportunity came to join Tech Review as chief operating officer, which is how I started here, I wasn't quite sure. And I hadn't, when I was at The Economist, I wasn't really on the traditional media side. I was more on the business to business side. I wasn't on the consumer side. So I was curious about what the opportunity here would look like.
That's quite a change in culture as well.
Oh, it was completely different in ways that both good and, you know, perhaps more challenging. So it was clear that there was something really valuable here, that there was a brand, that there was a reputation for producing good technology-related content, but that it was not getting anywhere close to the kind of attention and audience that it needed because it was operating in a very print, kind of from a very print perspective still. So the first thing we did was build the events business. They had built an events brand for a number of years. They had an events brand, but it really hadn't gotten the kind of attention and investment that I thought it needed and demanded. And so it was clear that we had a lot more mileage we could get out of events. I realized that was clearly a product that worked and that was special, but that needed to be really thought about differently from a commercial standpoint. So we built that kind of right away and started to invest in doing more branded events, Technology Review, MTech branded events. And that has proven to be quite a successful sort of part of the business model development. But we also began to think about how to build the digital audience. So when I started, there wasn't even any social media editorial work going on. So we needed to get a social media presence going. We needed to build a digital newsletter strategy. And now we have quite a few digital newsletters that, you know, go out every day and every week to our readers and that bring, you know, really engaged, loyal readers back to our site on a regular basis. We also needed to do a redesign. So this took a little bit longer. This didn't happen until I became CEO, but we then did a website redesign so that we have a feed on our site. And then we also redesigned the print magazine in order that we could have thematic print magazines. We publish 6 times a year, and a thematic approach means that when you are having that immersive, what they call it at The Economist, lean back experience, that you are fully immersed in the topic of that theme, rather than trying to have print be kind of a less interactive, less engaging, less kind of up-to-date and current version of what is on the website. We instead said, all right, let's make this actually play to the strengths of print, which is that when you're reading print, you're immersive, you're sitting back, you've decided it's time now for me to really understand what's going on with technology and China, or what's going on with technology and politics, or whatever the topic may be for that thematic issue. And then that, of course, is complemented by the constant sort of more news-driven cadence of the digital website experience. And then the other things we've done quite a lot that you can't see, that's sort of more behind the scenes, things having to do with our tech stack and whatnot. But another thing that was sort of visible to the world was we did some experimentation in podcasts to sort of figure out, well, how would this work for Tech Review? What's a good way of manifesting this audio, and where should we really kind of make some bets? So a lot of different sort of levels to our transformation, and it has been extremely exciting.
And has that managed to bring a kind of a different or a younger audience to you?
Absolutely, yeah. So our audience, as you probably expect, a print audience is an older audience than a digital, yeah. And so by virtue of growing our digital audience, we are, of course, attracting a whole lot more people to the brand overall, which is good in all kinds of ways you might imagine.
And did that older audience get on board with some of the changes in print? Because that's often where publishers hit issues with redesigns and things, is that their older audience switch off.
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenge for sure. An entirely print audience is hard to make sense business-wise of today. And so what we are really trying to do is get people who only experience us in print to, at the very least, have a newsletter, that, you know, digital newsletter that enables them to see what they aren't getting by not seeing us more frequently digitally. And, that's a process. There's all kinds of things having to do with the channel by which you reach a print audience. You've got to then figure out, well, how am I going to connect with them in order to encourage them to engage with us digitally? You've got to do things like get email addresses and whatnot. So that's a process. We've got a ways to go yet there. But people who are traditional print readers, who also have begun to experience us digitally, we see that they are much stickier, that their renewal rate, the renewal rate for that cohort is higher than folks who didn't experience us digitally at all. So that makes it clear what we need to do. And, you know, there's a set of steps that we're taking to make that happen.
I suppose you've got to think in terms of the future as well. You can't just be keeping old people happy.
No, that's right. And, you know, and I think, if you're only experiencing us print, then having a themed issue approach might be hard, because you might say, well, I don't really care about, you know, longevity. And that was one out of my six issues. So I'm not sure if the value's there in the subscription. But if you're experiencing us in all the ways that you can, then you understand that this is a themed kind of immersive, you know, almost more of a book experience that you're getting out of print that complements the steady all topics, both news-driven and more feature-led digital product that we also offer besides. And so it's really an important part of telling the value proposition story to people who are trying to decide how they want to experience us.
And a lot of the stuff you cover on your website, it's kind of that intersection of science and technology. That can be quite challenging to cover because you've probably got audiences ranging from like complete experts to people who are just have a passing interest. So how do you strike that balance between getting content that appeals to the experts don't find too basic, but also that can be understood by, you know, passing members of the public?
So we're very clear that we're not writing for the experts. We are interviewing the experts. We expect that they will be amongst the readers of our articles. But we're not an academic, although we're owned by an academic institution, we are not an academic publication. And so what we're trying to do is make technology and science accessible to a broader audience. What that means in practical terms is that if you are a tech expert, or you're a you know, an academic who's deeply immersed in AI or deeply immersed in biomedicine or whatever it might be, you yourself might not find our article to be groundbreaking, but it will tell the story of the kinds of things that you do in a, on a you know day-to-day basis in a way that you know your family members or your neighbors would understand and find interesting. And so although the people who are the experts themselves won't necessarily find anything new in the content that's associated with their areas of expertise, they will also know if there's anything that's stupid in it. That doesn't make any sense, right? So we're aware that they'll read it, but they will read it with a different understanding of what it's trying to do, and they'll share it. They'll pass it on to people who they want to better understand, you know, help to better understand their topic areas, and they will tell us if they think it's rubbish, right? So what we're aware of is that they are amongst the people who read it, but it's not about trying to break new news, for instance, in these fields. As far as an expert is concerned, it's about trying to explain the developments that are happening in these fields to a broader audience. But we're always very aware of the importance of maintaining the credibility that, you know, that is a huge part of what the value that we bring.
And that kind of area, that intersection, it's a field that's become quite crowded, I'm thinking particularly in the last 3 to 4 years. You've got brands like Wired that are very well known. So what do you do at Technology Review to stand out? You know, what's different?
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing we think about and talk about all the time. And when I was trying to decide, for instance, if I wanted to take the, you know, join this company 4 years ago, I was asking myself the same question. And, you know, there's a couple things. So Technology Review is the first ever technology publication. It was established in 1899 when publishing about technology was not a thing.
I don't think technology was barely a thing.
Exactly. So, you know, we've got a legacy and a reputation, but there are no guarantees associated with that. You know, you have to stay relevant. You have to stay connected with where audiences are going. You have to understand what makes you special to those audiences. And it isn't necessarily what made you special, you know, a decade or more ago. So we're very cognizant of what other tech publications are out there doing. And you're right, it's a crowded field. And what we're trying to be very clear about is that we're looking at a technology as it impacts the way we all live and work. And we're doing that from a place of authority, influence, and established expertise. And that place is quite simply MIT. So we're very aware that we carry the letters MIT and we carry the kind of reputation that comes with that. And we lean into the authority and the credibility that gives us, even as we're aware that we have to, you know, kind of earn it every day. So it's quite an interesting place to be because our intention is to own the category, to be the established brand in technology media. We're not there now, but that's a part of the our path. That's where we're heading.
I suppose that's where that word legacy has a more positive connotation if you're talking about credibility.
That's right. And, you know, it's also quite interesting, Esther, we could talk, you know, another time about the importance of maintaining independence, because we are owned by MIT, but we're independent from MIT. So there's a you know, it's important that we lean into the advantages that it gives us while not being about publishing on MIT per se. You know, we publish about what's going on at Stanford or universities or you know, the private sector. It's really not specific to, you know, what we publish is not specific to what's happening around us, you know, geographically around us, but rather what's happening kind of in the ecosystem, the center of which is our institutions like MIT.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier you'd experimented a bit with podcasts this year. Can you talk a bit about that and what you've learned and what you're planning for next year?
Yeah, it's great. We learned a lot. So we launched it as an experiment. We did a podcast that's, you know, lives on. It's called Business Lab, or shortened to Blab. And it was about trying to test out. We had some interest from some sponsors, and we wanted to test out, well, what would it really require to build an audience? What would it really require to do a whole bunch of, you know, connecting with editorial, connecting with sponsorship? You know, what was that kind of the magnitude of the ask? And so I hosted it, which was not, I think, not ideal. Made a lot of sense for a bunch of reasons, kind of boring inside reasons. But it's, you know, ultimately, and I've got another job. And I think one of the big things we realized is how important it was going to be to have someone who thought every day in audio terms about how to tell stories and how to bring out noise and voices and ambient sound and all that kind of cool stuff that makes podcasts such a special medium. But we did learn that the audiences would come, that the sponsors would come, that it was really easy to find ideas for episodes and things we could create. I mean, we had way more ideas than we ended up doing anything with.
That's always a good starting point.
Yeah, and we understood that we were very much sort of scratching the surface. And so what we learned out of that, and that pretty much was entirely focused in, we only really did that in 2019, and I believe we launched it in the beginning of the calendar year. So now we've hired, we've made two hires. We've hired someone who's previously at Wall Street Journal and built the Future of Everything brand, including the podcast. And she's quite actively working on building out something, which I won't say much more about. And then we also hired someone who's been kind of a long time, who formerly worked here, began to develop a podcast himself and has a popular podcast in the science space, to do another podcast is much more concentrated on a little bit of sort of behind the scenes at Tech Review, sort of how we operate, how we get stories, how we connect with the scholars in our field, with leaders in our field. So there's a whole bunch of interesting things that he's working on too. So those two podcasts will take flight in early 2019, or sorry, 2020.
Yeah, I was going to say 2020 now. Mm. And you've talked a bit about some of the changes you've made over the past 5 years. What are you doing to ensure MIT Technology Review is ready for the next 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, there's no guarantee that, I mentioned I was at The Economist before I came here, and it's an amazing place, an amazing experience. And it's, I think, a very clear lesson of success in the past is no guarantee of success in the future. And so what we've done quite a bit of, and I mentioned also sort of behind the scenes stuff, is a lot of investing in tools. So we've rebuilt our tech stack. That's not a investment I felt like I didn't want to make that investment. But we had to have tools that were able, that were up to the job that of a, being a digital media company in 2019 and beyond. And so we needed to have tools that would give us insights so we could take decisions.
Was that easy to get everybody else on board with?
Eventually, yeah. I mean, I think the challenge was, you know, transforming the business from a legacy print publication to a digital media brand is something that a lot of people say they are excited about doing, and I genuinely believe them. But when it actually plays out and when it actually occurs, and it means what you're doing has to change from this to that, it's not always easy. So in particular, a lot of the technology investments, we really needed to wait until I had the right person to lead that operation, that part of the business. And then once I had the right person, it all kind of came together much more quickly and with greater, you know, kind of confidence after his arrival. But I mean, the point was that if we really want to stay relevant and we really need to think about the sort of the next 5 years and the future of media and all that good stuff, we had to have tools to enable us to see. We had to have the visibility on what is our audience doing when they hit our site? Where are they coming from? How much time are they spending on these stories versus those stories? What are they doing after they've read these stories versus those stories? Can we play around with different ways of directing them to recirculate on the site from different kinds of stories and see what kind of impact those kinds of modifications would make? So all that is now possible at last, but it took quite some time. The other part of it is that, you know, looking ahead, we are also looking at evolving the business model to complement the journalism with other kinds of media products. So again, you know, we're aware that you know, obviously advertising in digital media it doesn't have a massive future for the business, particularly for a publication of our size or of our sort of specificity. So, you know, and we're looking at building payer sort of reader supported revenue, and so that's again about understanding when people hit our site and they hit the subscribe button and they carry through the transaction, what was their experience before they got to that point, and how do we replicate that with more of our audience? And similarly, once they are a subscriber, how do we nurture them and keep them engaged so that they renew? But even so, you build up all that and you still need to kind of figure out, well, where is really going to be the some additional sources of stability? And we're spending a lot of time thinking about B2B media and what the opportunities might look like for Technology Review to build out some more business-oriented product.
Are you optimistic about our future with technology, or do you kind of share concerns that experts have said about AI kind of taking over humanity and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I'm not worried about AI taking over humanity. I think I do have worries about the future of humanity. But I'm not sure that I would attribute my concerns to AI per se. I mean, I'm much more worried about the climate crisis, for instance. And we are publishing a lot about technologies that will help us adapt to climate change, since climate change is an inarguable reality. So I would say I'm more concerned about those sorts of threats. And also, because I think technology will be a path to, again, adaptation, I feel more of an optimism there. In terms of worries about what is the future of AI, I mean, I've been in too many conversations with too many genius, brilliant people about the steps and the consciousness that they're applying to the way AI is being developed and deployed to think that it's all going to go, you know, down the tragic path. I mean, I think in human history, we've often said this. And I think that we will, in this context, I think we will take the right decisions to control the threat side of things. At least that's what I'm hoping. But I do want to see us do things like apply it to the big thorny challenges like, you know, disease, like hunger, like, you know, as I said, climate. So, and I think that's probably the way, I think that's the way most people are really thinking about it, rather than, you know, the machines taking over.
As you know, we ask all our guests what the last thing is you read or saw or watched or listened to which really affected you.
I'm constantly reading, listening, watching. I'm a junkie for all media. But I guess what I was thinking about, what am I addicted to right now? And I am addicted to an app called Audm.
Okay.
AUDM. It's read articles, journalistic articles, long reads, and it's through an app, and I can listen to it in my car and my AirPods or whatever And, you know, I'm no longer, you know, reading The New Yorker in print or digitally. I am listening to the, you know, reading of the latest articles. I'm just really enjoying it because I'm constantly, you know, commuting and doing this and that. And so it's got a large number of Condé Nast publications and a whole bunch of other really top media brands in there besides. You can kind of pick which ones you want to listen to and which articles you want to listen to. And, you know, I've got these wonderful human read renderings of, you know, sort of what everybody's talking about. But I haven't had to sit down and read them. I've had them read to me while I sit in traffic. So it's not
automated reading.
No, it's not. It's humans. And actually, there's not that many voices either. There's maybe five or six of them. So you get kind of a certain, I've gotten a little bit familiar with some of the voices. I like it. I think it's great.
So before we finish up, just a quick mention for an event we're partnering with in February, which is called Making Publishing Pay. So it's aimed particularly at addressing some of the challenges and opportunities open to small and medium publishers. So far, it's got a really good lineup of speakers, including some we've had on the podcast. So Sean Dagan Wood from Positive News, Laura Jenner from Immediate Media. They've also got Lucia Adams from the I newspaper and Rory Brown from Agribriefing coming. So it's on at XL London from the 25th to the 26th of February, and you can see makingpublishingpay.com for more details.
If you are desperate for more Media Voices content, please do go to our website, which can be found at voices.media. Up there, we have transcripts of all the interviews we've done and links to some articles we've written elsewhere on the web. You can also follow us at Media Voices Pod on Twitter.
And if you don't have fear of commitment, then you can give us your email address and we'll send you a newsletter once a week. It's lovely. Do it. It's going to be great.
But until next week, when we're going to be back with another fantastic guest and a look through all the news and views from the media world, thanks very much for listening and goodbye.
Goodbye.